Here's a riddle. What has Iron Man, Thor, Black Panther, Captain America, the Guardians of the Galaxy, Doctor Strange, Black Widow, and Spider-Man? If you said the children's cartoon underwear department, you might be right. But if you said Avengers Infinity War, then you're thinking what we're thinking.
If you feel like Marvel movies are accelerating, you're correct. This is the seventh in 2 years. But Infinity War more fully integrates the Guardians of the Galaxy and Black Panther into the great big sprawling family that's been dominated for years by Captain America and Iron Man. And they're all teaming up to keep some magic stones away from a very bad purple monster. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Avengers Infinity War today on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. With me and Stephen is Glenn Weldon from the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair from NPR's Code Switch team, Gene Demby. Hey, Gene.
What's good, Joe?
And before we talk about this, we should say we're trying not to spoil any more than necessary. But if you're trying to go in cold, go see the movie, then come back, listen to this conversation then. And that way you won't know anything until you see it for yourself. Glenn, you reviewed this film for NPR. What did you say about it? What did you think of it?
I said it pretty much delivers on its promise. It feels like a culmination. It feels like something that's been long in the making. It still feels, even at 2 hours and 40 minutes, which people should know before going in, it still feels overstuffed, unwieldy. It felt to me like I was reading I was 12 years old and reading a summer comics crossover event, which are all about slamming people together, slamming events and raising the stakes, looking great, meaning that some characters get short shrift, some characters maybe get too much screen time. But the way they drill down, the way they make this whole unwieldy story work is by pairing off characters. And they pair off characters that we know we already are invested in the relationship and we like it, like Tony Stark and Peter Parker. But what works about this is that even characters we haven't really seen interacting, when they do, we think, oh, yeah. That's what would happen. Mm-hmm. That's what they'd be like.
I think in particular, they allow Thor to spend some time with Peter Quill.
Yep.
So you've got your Chris Pratt and your Hemsworth kind of coming together in a battle of Chris's, but also in a really weirdly correct kind of, as you said in the review, sort of like pretty boy
doofuses
sort of colliding. Mm-hmm. And the way that they get under each other's skin is, I think, really effective, quite funny.
Sure. Because these characters work on different levels, different tones, when they come together, it feels like varied.
Yeah.
Now, I would say that in Civil War and in Age of Ultron, when there's a big battle scene, that felt orchestrated and planned in a very kind of intricate way. And this feels more like a heavy metal like clash of just noise. And that also makes sense.
Yeah.
I will say that, you know, again, we talked about the character interaction. Yeah. Tony Stark and Doctor Strange come in together. They have a goatee off. That makes sense. I will say that of all the interactions in this film, the one that they try to put a lot of weight on, which is between Thanos, I think Thanos is the weak link in this film, Thanos and Gamora, we can't be invested in it, so it's all these scenes between them just don't really go anywhere. That said, it's a ride. I wrote the review in a weird way by saying, you're coming at this film from a lot of different places. Some people really know this universe well. Some people just want a ride. Some people are really invested in one character. Black Panther usually is the people to think about. And so you have to kind of say it's a lot of things to different people. But basically, I'm saying this thing delivers on its promise.
Yeah, I felt like it did too. Gene, what did you think?
That's exactly what I thought too. I thought it was like, there's so many character dynamics to sort of play with and so many plot threads to play with that you would imagine it would be like really hard to, I mean, that's the thing, like as more of these things were out there in the universe, in the Marvel cinematic universe, like how do you nail the landing? How do you stick the landing? And it did it like as good a job as you might imagine could be done, right? I mean, the place it actually ends up is so audacious.
I agree.
That like, it's almost like you'd have to roll a lot of things back for the next movie to make sense.
Or I wonder if there's any way that they can roll things back.
But of course, like, and this is the problem, right? Is that like, because these things can be rolled back, like what are the stakes then, right?
There is my issue.
One of the things, I'm curious about how you guys think about this, was I love the Thor stuff. It's like very funny, but a lot of Thor's humor sits right next to, and this is not like a spoiler, this is like the first scene of the movie, like sits right next to like a genocide, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there's this weird sort of tonal shifting. It's like, I appreciate these jokey jokes between Star-Lord and Thor, but also, would Thor be making this joke right now? Like, is that where he would be in his spirit right now?
I think that's true of this story, and it's also true of a lot of movies like this. I think once they got through the Battle of New York and the Avengers, and you had had this sort of massive destruction and tons of death, you're already in a situation where You know, it feels off for it to be jokey in some ways, but it's also the only way, at least for me, to stay engaged. Stephen, what did you think?
On balance, I really liked it. I felt it was, for a movie that was as long as it was, it's so, I think, expertly paced and directed. The Russo brothers who directed it, you know, had to integrate so many plots and so many characters. My fear going in was that it was going to be 160 minutes of just nonstop pummeling, that it was going to be this exhausting onslaught of Byzantine exposition and thundering generic villains and cities getting smashed to pieces. But I felt like they did a nice job of fleshing that out with moments of quiet. There's enough moments of quiet that weren't boring that you were able to kind of reset yourself, and it didn't feel exhausting. I enjoyed a lot of the crossovers. I enjoyed some of the integration of different fighting styles, kind of the way I did in like Captain America Civil War. Mm-hmm. I think where I struggled with this movie is kind of right there in the title, Infinity War. We have set the stakes at the fate of the entire universe. Mm-hmm. And as such, there's this weird effect where by making the stakes that big, it somehow diminishes them. You kind of feel as you're going along like, okay, well, if the fate is the universe, obviously it's going to turn out a certain way, right? This is really the first half of a five-hour movie. Mm-hmm. Nothing is really resolved in this movie. And I think it's important for the really passive viewers to know that they are seeing part one out of a two-movie piece. Yeah. Where do you go from we have to save the universe?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we talked about when we saw Spider-Man Homecoming is that one of the things that was good about that film is that the stakes were more specific and smaller. And that's true to, pardon me for being this person, but like that's true to who Spider-Man is. Like he's more of an on the ground kind of city based hero, which is one of the things they play with in this film is him being outside of that realm and more into this big universe thing. Both the Avengers and then Civil War were heavily invested in the relationship between Cap and Iron Man.
Right, yeah.
And that was the fundamental tension of both of those films in a lot of ways. And in this one, I don't think it's spoilery to say you're not spending a lot of time with that relationship.
No.
You're spending a lot of time with a lot of other relationships that they're developing. But I have to assume that eventually they're coming back to that story.
Right.
And I care about that. If the only stakes are, can they save the universe? I agree with you. That's not that interesting. At a smaller scale, it's interesting to follow stuff like, you know, if you have a character out of Black Panther and a character out of the Avengers fighting together, that's interesting and fun to watch, regardless of whether you feel like, well, eventually they're going to win. Like,
yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of these superhero films have what we call third act problems, where it just builds and builds and builds, and there's crazy CGI villain at the end, and there's a big fight, and you lose that thread of the character. I think with Thanos, you have a first act problem and a second act problem and a third act problem, because he's a silly CGI villain with a very silly quest, a satisfying quest. It's kind of fun to see him collect the gems, the Infinity Stones. It's kind of, you know, there's a certain satisfying character to that, but he has the power to warp reality, and he still punches people a lot. That is endemic. That's in the comics. That's what comics are about. Like, I have unimaginable power. I could crush you with a thought, and yet I'm going to punch you. I do think, explain to me, guys, what Josh Brolin is doing exactly. He is restrained. He is not chewing the scenery. I mean, there is a great moment when he does call somebody going, insect. I love that. Mm-hmm. That's part of the deal. Mm-hmm. But he's really more wistful, and they're trying. On paper, it works. On paper, he is not a big evil villain. He's got a rationale. That's what you want. That's what Killmonger had. He had a rationale. You might not agree with him. And Killmonger worked, I think, because he was a human being, and this is a giant purple CGI.
I think that's part of what it is. I think what they're trying to go for is a very similar idea to Killmonger. I think what they're trying to go for is a guy who, you know, his idea is that by destroying a lot of the universe, you save the rest of it. That's basically his way of going about things. And I think they do want you to understand that there is a rationale for that. And there is a rationale under which essentially this is a piece about not just overpopulation in a literal sense, but kind of over too much everything, right? Mm.
In a way, it's kind of a stand-in for the idea that everything is a zero-sum game, right? Mm. That, like, if that only X number of people can be happy, and that there's a finite amount of happiness and resources mm-hmm. in the universe. I mean, I felt like they were kind of getting at an interesting idea, but kind of breezed by it. I appreciated that he wasn't thundering all the time mm-hmm. the way some of those CGI villains do.
Like the Steppenwolf in terrible, right? Because we've only seen him in glimpses in the previous MCU movies, right? Like sort of like in the post-credit scenes or whatever, like they had to do so mm-hmm. much work with him. Like, I mean, in all the moments with Gamora, like, I mean, like you said, they don't really make a lot of sense. Like, it's not really clear. I mean, I guess it's like, oh, you're my adopted daughter whose mother I killed. Like, we had this complicated relationship. It's like, yeah, I guess, but like,
not that complicated. I mean,
they want it to turn on surprises, but to be surprised, we have to be able to anticipate how they're going to react.
Right.
And we can't. So we can't be surprised.
Right.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. so a lot of the turns are just like, well,
yeah,
okay.
It's okay, sure. Right.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about Shrift earlier. Who did you want more of? Who did you feel was worst served? Because my vote is Cap.
I always want more Cap. Cap is sort of my, and that's not just my like, oh, like Chris Evans, but like, I think he's a very interesting character. I think in some ways he's the one who has progressed the most over the course of this series, I think. You know, Chris Evans has always played him as kind of a bruised dude. Like, uh-huh. increasingly as the series goes on, I think he shows the wear of the experiences of all these things, maybe more than any of the other characters. And I think that I always want more of him. I assume you're going to get more of him in the other half of it. I could be wrong. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to see this who are going to want a lot more Black Panther. And that's just because it's a ton of people's favorite movie and they're like a couple months out of it. Mm. And, you know, there's a decent amount of Black Panther, but it's not the central focus of like, and it's mostly in the third act. It's basically a part of the third act more than the rest.
See, I felt like they captured the feel of like Guardians of the Galaxy much more than they were able to capture the feel of Black Panther. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of scenes set in Wakanda, but it doesn't feel like watching Black Panther the way there are scenes that feel like you're watching Guardians of the Galaxy. To me, it feels, with Captain America, it feels like Chris Evans walked into this movie off the set of a movie where he was playing a guy with a beard. and like, he feels almost digitally inserted in this movie. I was shocked at how little I felt like I was even watching Captain America. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to Glenn's point earlier about the way that the big fights in Civil War felt like choreographed and sort of set up, there was a way that I was looking for some of that in this movie. Like, you see this brief moment where you see T'Challa and Captain America running ahead of like the sort of vanguard. You're like, oh, right, these people are like superhumanly enhanced. Like, and it's like, oh, it would have been nice to like see more of them fighting alongside each other, because that battle does feel like just chaos, right? Which is fine. I mean, like, it would be chaos.
And they're hand fighters. Like, the whole thing is the Wakanda fighting force.
Mm-hmm.
They have certain weapons.
Ranged weapons, but
mostly. They do a lot of hand fighting. Mm-hmm. You know.
There's a way in which, like, you can imagine that scene feeling a little bit more satisfying with the people sort of bouncing off each other. And you get a little bit of that with Okoye, Black Widow, and Scarlet, which is a scene that's really cool there. Mm-hmm. But you don't get a lot of, like, the characters sort of, like, who have, like, complementary skill sets sort of bouncing off each other and, like, doing something really dope.
Sometimes a movie like this, you can view the plot as a puzzle a little bit, and you think, like, how are they going to get out of this pickle? And in this, you kind of know, right? You just kind of know.
No, I don't know. I don't know for sure.
But if you get out of the pickle the way that I imagine most of us think they'll get out of the pickle, it's going to be like, oh, but that's so cheap.
Right.
You know?
No, I know.
It's like,
right. That's the problem. But you can't be angry at a movie because of what you think a movie a year from now is going to do. Like,
there is that.
That's true. I don't think that's
I can be preemptively angry, Linda.
Yeah. And I want to say one other thing. I will say about Gamora, though, when you talk about how hard it is to get the emotional stakes out of that story, let me just say, if you don't develop the love interest character that you have put in a movie to be the love interest, then when you need her as a real person, you haven't built her.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons to do it, is that you enrich your entire universe. I think they built her as a love interest for him in Guardians. I don't think they adequately built that character. And now when they want her to carry her own story, she's not adequately kind of developed enough. Well, I think it's safe to say that many of you will see Infinity War.
A couple
of you. When you have, we definitely want to hear what you think about it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Stonyfield Organic Kids. If you like organic stuff and your kids like yummy stuff, Stonyfield makes it easy. With a whole bunch of organic yogurt treats, like convenient cups, pouches, smoothies, and tubes, they're always ready to go. Best of all, Stonyfield is made without the use of toxic persistent pesticides, artificial hormones, antibiotics, or GMOs. If you're ready for yum, visit stonyfield.com/NPR. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Bravo's Imposters. Follow Maddie, a con artist on the run, desperately trying to live an honest life, and her three bumbling victims who get swept up into the life of the con. The feds want to lock them up. A crime boss wants to do much worse. Every con has consequences. Imposter stars Inbar Levy, Rob Heaps, Parker Young, Marion Rendon, and features Uma Thurman. Imposters airs Thursdays at 10, 9 Central, only on Bravo.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week, and let's face it, every week. What is making us happy this week? Steve and Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, we just announced the winner of the fourth annual Tiny Desk Contest. Woo-hoo! And we have reached a point in this series. We talked about stakes at the beginning of this episode. We've reached the point where now one of the emotions I feel about this series is fear. Fear that we will choose the wrong person. Fear that we will have a Taylor Hicks on our hand, that we will have, having chosen our Carrie Underwood and our Fantasia Barrino and our Kelly Clark and our Ruben Studdard, we would suddenly come out with our Taylor Hicks, thereby precipitating the decline and ultimate end of the series.
Gene's over there like, hand up, Ruben Studdard.
Excuse me. Case in point.
Oh, man.
We chose in season one, Fantastic Negrito, who has since won a Grammy. We've chosen Galen Lee, whose song, go watch her Tiny Desk concert. It is wonderful. She's been touring the country. She's great. Tank and the Bangas, just who are so ridiculously amazing, signed a deal with a major label. They are like on a rocket ride to superstardom. So I came in like, how do you follow Tank and the Bangas? We follow Tank and the Bangas with the great and good Naya Izumi, whose song is called Soft Spoken. As of this taping, he has not yet come in and performed at the Tiny Desk. Those concerts are always wonderful. But his video that won the Tiny Desk contest is called Soft Spoken, and it is this mix of kind of unusual and really, I think, technically dazzling guitar work with this beautiful voice. And to me, he conjures a lot, and I don't say this lightly, he conjures a lot of what I love about Jeff Buckley.
Baby, a book by its cover, Lisa, and you are my being, a soft-spoken person, but I'm aware.
So yeah, that's Soft Spoken by Naya Izumi, the winner of the fourth annual Tiny Desk contest. I'm so, so happy about this pick.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, Betty?
Kylie Minogue is an Australian pop fan.
She sure is.
Here's what you got to know about Kylie. She is a survivor. She's going to outlast us all. It's going to be her and the cockroaches standing around barrel fires with fingerless gloves and off-the-shoulder jerseys. That's just the way it's going to be. Case in point, on March 9th, she released a new song called Stop Me From Falling. It was country-inflected. That song came out on March 9th, didn't go anywhere, got mixed reviews. Some people said she's trying too hard. Now, that's Kylie Minogue.
I was going to say, Kylie Minogue.
That's her thing. That's like saying Taylor Swift writes a lot of songs about herself. That's what she
that's
do.
How she gets down. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. So on April 20th, there was a remix. Brand new video, and see if you can tell. I'm going to play a little clip from it. See if you can tell how she mixed it up a little bit. You can get the country, right? A little line dancing. Pretty straightforward so far.
Oh, yeah.
Here it comes. Ha ha! She's getting her Despacito on. Yes, she is. Of course she is.
Wow.
That is a remix with the Cuban reggaeton group Gente de Zona. Look, there's nothing cynical necessarily about incorporating Latin rhythms and melodies and instrumentation and arrangements. Long history of pop chanteuse is doing that. You got your Linda Ronstadt, you got Kirsty MacColl, you got your David Byrne. So there's nothing inherently cynical and grasping about it unless you're Kylie Minogue.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, that video is filmed on the streets of Havana. It's a lot of fun. And she looks great. She dances. So that is Stop Me From Falling. The remix is out now. And it's great.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. What a great pick. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
So last week, the New York Times updated us on one of the great dramas of our time. A long time ago, in 2007, there was this documentary called The King of Kong.
Yeah, there was.
It is Fistful of Quarters.
A Fistful of Quarters. It's actually one of the great documentaries.
Agreed.
Probably the last 20 years. Like, I mean, the stakes in this documentary are so low that everything... And they matter so much to the players involved, literally the players involved. It's a riveting documentary, but also, like, the people almost... don't seem like they could be real people. They
so,
seem
the,
like,
so these people play Donkey Kong competitively.
There's like a sort of a regular guy who like
he's a math teacher. I think a high school math teacher.
Plays in his garage.
He's kind of mild mannered, right? Yeah.
Mild mannered, and then
he supposedly has the our protagonist. He's the good guy. He's like a little down on his luck. That's what it's implied in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he's apparently set the record for Donkey Kong in this documentary, the highest score ever. His nemesis is this dude. I mean, you can't even, like, if he were a fictional character, you'd be like, that's too much. Like, you're doing too much. Like dial it back a little bit. This dude named Billy Mitchell. He's the hot sauce king of Hollywood, Florida. he like only talks about himself in the most grandiose ways.
Mm-hmm.
He has this crazy, like, goatee mullet situation. So the New York Times updated us on the sort of the drama at the center of this movie. Apparently, Steve Wiebe, the mild-mannered math teacher, has been vindicated because apparently there were some shenanigans, which is ridiculous. There were some shenanigans in the construction of the Donkey Kong machine that Billy Mitchell was using. And so Steve Wiebe is now the rightful heir for the all-time highest score in Donkey Kong. Just wanted, this is like an excuse to plug that movie because it is really a well-done, well-told story.
So you can find that update, and I think it's safe to say a lot of other coverage recently.
Absolutely.
You can follow the Billy Mitchell story in the New York Times or elsewhere.
Yep.
Thank you very much,
no problem.
Gene Demby. So we have not talked on this podcast about the Netflix series Wild Wild Country.
Oh.
But many other people have been talking about it. Wild Wild Country is a documentary series on Netflix about the Rajneesh, the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, which was one of the names that he went by, who was a guru who set up a commune in Oregon, in rural Oregon, in the 1980s. And the documentary follows the clash between the members of this commune who followed this guru, many of whom are sort of appear to be white hippies rather than, you know, it's really complicated, the politics of it. But they come in and the rural Oregonians hate them because they're weird. But also the group, or the cult, as a lot of people called it, is also very aggressive toward the locals in a lot of ways and is very bent on kind of taking over, literally taking over town government. And so it is this fascinating story in which I liked no one.
That's exactly right.
I couldn't like the townspeople because they did appear to be completely prejudiced against people who were different. And, you know, the fact that it was like an Eastern religion, I think, was part of their suspicion. These people are weird. They're strange. The guru, of course, is a brown person, as is his second in command, Sheila.
Speaking of supervillains.
Maybe the most interesting person in a documentary this year is Sheila, who wound up being held responsible for a lot of the ultimate wrongdoing that was prosecuted by members of this group. She wound up being blamed. Gene, you've clearly seen this.
It is.
Just from your face. The contortions we're seeing.
This documentary, like, will play with your allegiances so much. Because at first, when you meet the townspeople, like, oh, these are, like, sort of, like, bigoted. But as the time goes on, you realize that, like, there's, like, I can't ride with these people at all. Like, they take over, like, the police, right? They take over the police. Like, so, yeah. You know, like, mm-hmm. maybe they shouldn't have weapons, right? You know? And maybe they shouldn't be enforcing the rules. And like, apparently this story is the story that, like conservatives in America point to when they, this is not a spoiler necessarily, but when they point to voter fraud and the point to the dangers of voter fraud, they point to this story.
Oh, wow.
And I did not know that. Apparently, like, this is a really important sort of case in Americans' fight about voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, like, the fifth most interesting or, like, disturbing thing about it. It's so crazy.
It is intense, man. It is really intense. And you should have a reading group where you just go talk about Sheila for 3 hours after you watch this. So Wild Wild Country, available on Netflix. That is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEEDEE215. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the in and out music you're bobbing your head to. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We will see you right back here next week.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.